Nicholas Fox Weber is an art historian and a writer. He graduated from Columbia College and Yale University, is the director of the Joseph and Annie Albers Foundation, and the author of many books, biographies and catalogues. In the 70s, when he was still a student, he had the chance to meet Joseph and Annie Albers, with whom he spent many hours till both, Joseph in 1976 and Annie in 1994, passed away. He was a close friend of them, and a person whom they told their stories, whose spirit he succeeded in capturing, revealing beyond their extraordinary objectives in making art and teaching their personal lives. We met him in Modena on the occasion of the Joseph Albers retrospective at the Galleria Civica, an exhibition curated by Marco Pierini. Mr. Fox Weber, let's begin talking about the high regard Joseph Albers had for Giotto and the higher admiration he felt for Duccio. It is something people do little about.
I was terribly lucky to get to know both Annie and Joseph Albers very well in the 1970s, when Annie was in her 70s and Joseph was in his 80s. Annie Albers, who was a very strong woman, described to me her decision to go to the Bauhaus. In 1922, she was a rich young woman from Berlin. She was expected just to instruct the staff on how to prepare meals and to become a housewife. And instead, she told her parents she wanted to go to a new art school. The Bauhaus had been created in 1919. Her father, who was a furniture manufacturer, said, "What do you mean a new style? There are no new styles. There's been the Renaissance, there's been the Baroque. What else can there be?" But she persuaded him, and off she went. And this woman who was used to dressmakers and a butler now found herself in a simple rented room in Weimar, trying to be accepted at the Bauhaus. And there came a first Bauhaus Christmas, and she sat in the back of the room, expecting that Father Christmas, Santa Claus, would have nothing for her. She didn't think anyone even knew who she was. And then Father Christmas, who was Walter Gropius, the director of the Bauhaus School, called out the name Anneliese Fleischmann. She could hardly believe that there was something in Santa's bag for her. And she told me that she went forward and received a rolled-up print, and it was Giotto's Flight into Egypt, that wonderful image from Padua, and it was a gift from Joseph. So here you had two young artists at the Bauhaus, and how did Joseph, 11 years older than Annie, from a very different world, from an extremely poor family, his father was a heavy-drinking carpenter. How did Joseph express his love for Annie? Through a Giotto. And I found this story deeply moving and had never forgotten it. And one day, when Joseph Albers was about 87 years old, I had driven him and Annie to New York for lunch in the executive dining room of the Metropolitan Museum. And during lunch, Joseph had become quite ill, and I was extremely worried about him. He had had a somewhat of a fainting spell, and when we drove out of the city, I was driving their very nice Mercedes-Benz. Joseph was seated next to me, and Annie was on my right. And we opened the windows, driving along the Hudson River to get a little bit of fresh air in. And we were driving by the cloisters, where there's Romanesque art. And we began talking about Romanesque art. And then I said, "Mr. Albers, I've always loved the story that Annie told me about the Giotto print. I'm fascinated that you had such a high regard for Giotto." And he began talking to me with joy about Giotto. Now you have to understand, Joseph Albers had very little taste for the art of his own time. He did not like abstract expressionism. He wasn't very impressed with his most famous student, Robert Rauschenberg, but he loved certain things from the past. And as he was talking to me, he came back to life. He got the animation that had been missing during the day, and he began to gesticulate with his right hand. And he said, "You know, Nick, finally, much as I love Giotto, I prefer Duccio." And with his right hand, he began to indicate the line of a Duccio annunciation, the animation of the figure. And he said to me that Duccio's lines had such an excitement, such an energy.
Why do you think Albers loved Duccio?
Why does an artist love something? If you were to ask Joseph Albers, "Why did you love Duccio?" he might have said with great lust, were he having lunch, "For the same reason that I love Westphalian ham and dark bread, because there are certain things that nourish us, because there are certain things that fill us with a sense of excitement or a sense of well-being, or what we would call a very positive energy." Joseph loved art that was modest in the sense that a painter did not put forward his name. He objected greatly to big signatures, to artists declaring who they are. He objected to personal expression in art. Duccio wanted to reveal his sense of religion, his sense of God. Albers wanted to reveal color, his miracle. For Albers, color, the way that it changes, the way that it appears to change, and line are miracles. He saw his function on the earth as being a voice of the miracle. Well, you could say the same thing for Duccio. Duccio's desire was to express his sense of a very beautiful religious story. Duccio has a fantastic sense of color, a sense of balance. Lines respond to other lines. There's a modesty to the artistry, and there's a tremendous energy and a quality of joy, as there is in Joseph's work. And of course, the great question for me is, knowing that Joseph was such a spectacular artist in stained glass, in colored glass, did he see the window by Duccio? Did he know about that great window? When I look at that window, it's as if I see something of Joseph when I look at the Duccio. And the idea of light passing through colored glass and that being an expression of a sort of miracle is something that, of course, had great appeal for Joseph, whether he saw the actual work.
The idea one might have of Joseph Albers is that of an extreme rationality, but there is also something unpredictable about light, something magic about colors.
It's rational and irrational at the same time. Joseph, when asked how he picked his colors for the homages to the square, would look at his thousands of tubes of paint, and on the back of each painting, he would write the name of the color and the name of the manufacturer. Because as you may know, he painted every color directly on the white background. He never mixed paints, and he never put a color on top of another color. And if he used a Grimbacher Mars yellow, on the back he wrote Grimbacher Mars yellow. If he then used a Winsor Newton Mars yellow, he wrote that as well. But when asked how he picked his colors, he would say, "I study and I work and I study and I work, and then I pray to God." So rational, 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 and then there's an irrational side. I say irrational in the sense that Joseph could appear to be a scientist, but he was a poet. He could say he didn't want his own hand to show, but he lets his hand show. He had some great interest in spiritualism. In the exhibition here, you have a fantastic print called Tlaloc. Tlaloc was the Mexican rain god. Annie and Joseph Albers went to Mexico 14 times. They were deeply interested in Mayan religion. They loved the idea of temples and gods devoted to the sources of fertility, rain and sunshine. And Albers certainly had this great sense of a spiritual otherworld.
Would you tell us the story of Cosmic Joseph, the last homages he painted in 1976?
In 1976, Joseph Albers would be turning 88. He was fascinated with the number 8, which he saw to be a symbol of eternity. It's a continuous figure. He was to turn 88. He lived at 808 Birchwood Drive, by coincidence. He was born in 1888. He liked order. Like numbers. That January, his birthday was March 19th, that January, I by then was going to the Albers' house once or twice a week. I was writing a book about Annie Albers, and at the same time, I was helping them almost in any way I could. These people were extraordinary in their devotion to making art and their passion for art. And one January day, I walked in and I said, "How are you, Mr. Albers?" "Oh, I'm having a terrible time, Nick." "What's the problem?" "I'm trying to paint an homage." He said homage with almost a French pronunciation. "I'm trying to paint an homage." That in itself was unusual. He hadn't painted one since 73. And he was trying to do a painting, which he told me was a study for an Aubusson rug to be hung in Australia. And he was working in blues and greens, and he said to me, "Nick, I want to do one with a large central square." And he showed me the colors of blue and green, and he said that the central blue to him was the cosmos. The one around it, rather of blue-green, was the earth, and the next color surrounding it was the sea. And he said that as he tried to create this painting, with the paints that he had, he could realize certain objectives if he kept the middle square small, but he could not realize those objectives if he kept the middle square large. He did studies. He did half homages. By the way, you have one of the studies in the exhibition also. And Joseph said that the problem was in his paints, because he had done these studies and he discovered that if he could use a Winsor Newton cobalt green number 196 for the middle square, he would be fine. But the new Winsor Newton cobalt green number 205 was all that he had. And I said, "Well, Mr. Albers, I'll see if I can find you a tube of the old one, or several tubes." I phoned the art supply store that he always went to, Kay's in New Haven. I tried other art supply stores all over Connecticut. Everyone had the new Winsor Newton cobalt green. No one had the old one. Winsor Newton's an English company, but I phoned the corporate headquarters for America in New Jersey and spoke with the president of Winsor Newton America, and I asked if he had any access to the old Winsor Newton cobalt green number 196. And he said, "All our batches of cobalt green are the same. There's no difference." And I said, "Well, sir, I'm calling for Joseph Albers." And the man said, "Joseph Albers? The Joseph Albers?" By that point, Joseph had been the first living artist in America to have a solo retrospective at the Metropolitan Museum. This was no small thing. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I'll see what I can do." Several days later, a small box arrived at 808 Birchwood Drive, and in it were 5 tubes of Winsor Newton cobalt green 196. Joseph explained to me that in the version of the painting with the new cobalt green, He indicated with his hand below the central square. He said, downstairs is fine. Downstairs is paradise. And then with his hand, he indicated above it, and he said, but upstairs is hell. This meant that there was no interaction of color. He also told me that it was terribly important to him that the boundary lines around the cosmos not appear too sharp. He said to me, the cosmos should not have sharp edges or angular corners. And then he said to me, Cartier-Bresson, who had gone to photograph him a couple of times, Cartier-Bresson told me, Albers, you paint circular squares. And Joseph explained that this meant that the corners rather disappear. They don't appear too sharp. Now he did the painting that he wanted with the right cobalt green. He had achieved the interaction of color whereby a flat color can appear shaded and luminous. And he said to me that he was pleased with the result. And he said, I had to do the painting with the central square large, Nick, because I feel the cosmos getting nearer and nearer. And that was his last painting.
You had the chance to know Albers in the 70s. Many portraits render the image of a man retired from the public life. As much as he was ahead during the Bauhaus and the Black Mountain period, in the same way he seemed out of his own time in the years you met him. What were his opinion about life, art and politics at that time?
Joseph Albers was a man of very definite opinions about everything. He saw himself as a refugee in America, someone who had escaped Nazism, and he was very aware of what had happened in Germany after the closing of the Bauhaus. You asked me about his politics. He upset many people, and I suppose I'm among those who would have been upset had I known him at the time, because he would not join an art exhibition in protest of the Vietnam War. And he said he owed his safety and his well-being to being in America, and therefore he would not engage in official protest against what the American government was doing. I'm sorry about that. As an American, I was very opposed to the Vietnam War. It's a matter of personal taste or beliefs. When Annie and Joseph Albers arrived in the United States, they felt that Roosevelt was like an uncle to them. They never met him, but they felt that he offered a great sense of well-being. And generally, the way that they looked at politicians was astonishingly visual. So they both liked Nelson Rockefeller, who was a vice presidential candidate and a governor of New York, because he was famously passionate for art. And there was once a big inaugural dinner in the state of New York, and the guests arrived in evening clothes, and Governor Rockefeller was still in a flannel shirt installing a cauldron from the ceiling. Joseph and Annie loved that sort of devotion to the visual world. And I remember Joseph saying about Gerald Ford, who was an American president, he has a face like a knee. And that was very Albers, just to say he had a face like a knee, which I thought was extremely funny and a very strong opinion. During the Watergate hearings, Joseph was fascinated that one of the real culprits was John Ehrlichman, because in German, Ehrlichman means honest man. And here was a crook with the name Ehrlichman, and no one seemed aware of the pun of the name. Anyway, this was the sort of political observation one heard from the Albers. They did not, neither Joseph nor Annie, engaged in great political support or action or protest. Joseph did engage in protest against the Museum of Modern Art in the 1930s, because they weren't showing enough abstract art, and he was a member of the Abstract Artists Group in New York. And he felt that Alfred Barr, the director of the Modern, never forgave him for that protest. In the years when I knew him, he was quite unsympathetic to most of the art that was then popular in America. He did not have a high regard for Frank Stella, Ellsworth Kelly, Kenneth Noland, many of these artists. He didn't love their abstraction. His faith was in artists more of his own era, like Schwitters, Kandinsky, and Klee. He was intrigued by some of his students who weren't very well known, Julian Stanzak, Robert Angman, Robert Slutsky, Richard Anuskevich. These are not names that most people know, but Joseph was so devoted to some of his students. There was also one called Norman Carlberg, that he showed their work in his house rather than his own work. And if a museum director arrived, he would rather have the museum director look at the work of someone who was unknown and ask, "Who's that?" And then Joseph could tell him a bit about an unknown artist. He didn't like the trends of modern art, no interest in pop art. He once told Bridget Riley, you know who I mean? He told Bridget Riley, and she told me this, that Joseph said that the expression op art was like saying water swimming. All swimming takes place in water. All art is optical. He would rather talk about Giotto and Duccio than about Robert Rauschenberg or Robert Motherwell.
Was he aware of the legacy he would have left behind him? We know he wished art to be modest, in the sense he admired humble artists who created in terms of universality much more than in terms of individual expression. But what can you tell me about his modesty as human being paired with a consciousness of the great value of his teaching and practice?
He was modest, immodest. If Joseph Albers went to the photocopy shop, as he did almost every day, or the post office, he was a modest, polite, respectful human being. He never presented himself as the artiste. He never acted like a grand person, but he had a very, very strong sense of rightness and faith. And when he taught, he was teaching the truth, and he taught thousands of people. And he could kick the canvases of the students whose work he thought was bad. He could be quite brutal in his anger at art that he thought was inferior. He would shout at people he considered pretentious. And I believe that he had a very strong sense that his revelations of color would live on. He taught with a passion of very, very few people. He adored teaching. He taught in the official traditional way at the Bauhaus, at Black Mountain College and at Yale. He gave lectures in South America, Germany, various American universities, University of Honolulu, all over the place. But not only that, he loved to teach so much that when I would walk into the house, he saw, a young person I can teach, a young person to whom I can show the way that lines change if we put them in a certain structure, the way that colors appear different in different settings. He couldn't stop teaching.
If I'm not too intrusive, would you tell me how it did happen to you to meet Joseph Albers?
I'm happy to describe the circumstances of how I met Albers because it brings me to a line of Annie Albers. Annie Albers used to say, "You can go anywhere from anywhere." And I suppose that's why I'm happy to tell the way that I met the Albers, because you never know what will lead to what. In my case, in the summers, I went to Columbia College in New York, loved painting. My mother was a painter, my father a printer. I spent a great deal of time in museums, and in the summers, I taught tennis in New Hampshire, which is in the mountains of northern New England. And one summer, I became totally enchanted with a girl who was also teaching tennis, a couple years younger than I was. She did not return the interest for me that I had in her. This does happen sometimes in life. But she took me to meet her family, and they had a lot of work by both Joseph and Annie Albers, beautifully installed in their home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And her mother would have chosen me as a son-in-law. Her mother thought that I was a pretty good candidate, which, of course, was the kiss of death for the relationship with the girl. You understand this very well. But her mother decided, as a way of keeping me in the fold, to take me to meet Joseph and Annie Albers. And I was a graduate student at Yale in art history. Ruth Agus one day took me to meet Joseph and Annie. I put on my one clean pair of corduroy pants and a nice shirt because I thought meeting Bauhaus people, you should look neat. And then my MG wouldn't get started and I had to get underneath it and hammer the fuel pump with a rock. So I had grease on my pants, which I didn't think was right for meeting the Albers for the first time, but there was nothing I could do about it. We got to the Albers' house, and Joseph Albers, when Ruth Agus introduced him to me, didn't even say hello. He just said, "What do you do, boy?" And I said, I was very nervous meeting him. And Annie Albers was standing there smiling, not saying a word. And the Albers' house was a very simple American house. And at this point, Ruth Agus and I were at the entrance of the house, and Joseph and Annie were up half a flight of stairs, standing on a balcony. So I really felt as if I were practically in the witness box. I said, "I'm studying art history at Yale, sir." "Do you like it, boy?" Ugh, what a question. It was the middle of the Vietnam War. I didn't want to go into the army. I had a full fellowship. My education was being paid for. I didn't want to lose that. But nor was this a man you could dissemble with. You did not lie to Joseph Albers. And I said to him, knowing that I could be wrecking my future, I said to him, "No, sir, I really don't." "Why not, boy?" "Well, sir, I feel that I'm losing my passion for looking at art. In art history, they have me doing so much research that for a course called Surat and the Iconography of Entertainment, I've spent the past month and a half in a library basement researching gaslighting fixtures in 19th century France. And when I tried to speak with the professor about Surat's painting technique and his colors, the professor said, "This course is only to discuss iconography." At this point, Ruth Agus and I walked up the half flight of stairs, which became warranted by the conversation, and Albers said to me, "This I like, boy. Which of those bastards in art history don't you like?" I talked with him. He put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, "What does your father do?" Now, I wanted to tell him what my mother did. She was a painter, but I knew that this was a man who thought paternal lineage was the issue. And I said, "My father's a printer, sir." "Good boy. Then you're not just an art historian, you know something about something." And that was the beginning.